September 16th. After the soccer game on Saturday morning, Cheryl got in her Toyota van and headed north across the bridge that separates Oregon from Washington. She was going home to Longview. She was afraid. Her mother saw it. Betty had seen Cheryl afraid for a long time, but this weekend was different. There was a kind of tragic acceptance about Cheryl, as if she had done everything she could for her children, for herself, for the slightest chance that she and her three boys might have a happy future, or any future, together. Cheryl was strangely low-key on Saturday. She had always been a woman of tremendous energy, and the contrast with the way she had once looked and acted was shocking. "She just looked terrible," her sister Susan remembered. "She was exhausted, and she was so thin that you could see her rib cage. Her cheeks were caved in." On Saturday night, when Betty got up from the table to wash the supper dishes, Cheryl didn't move to join her. "She let me do the dishes alone," Betty said. "Cheryl always jumped up to help me." But she seemed at last to have run out of strength. She didn't talk about the custody battle, but she did speak of her worries about Philip, her baby. She said he was starting to stutter, and she was going to take him to a doctor. Betty's role over the previous year had been to calm Cheryl down, but she wasn't agitated that evening. She seemed beaten down. "My highs are not quite as high as they could be," she said, "and my lows are lower." Then she said quite softly, "I know you don't think he's going to kill me, Mom, but he is going to kill me." Betty stopped what she was doing and stared hard at Cheryl. It wasn't that this was the first time Cheryl had said she feared Brad would kill her. Betty had heard her say it almost a dozen times since November of 1985. She responded as she usually did. "He's too selfish to risk his butt." But then Betty felt a chill. This time she believed Cheryl, and she warned, "Don't be alone with him, Cheryl. Don't try to talk to him the way you would with other people. Watch your car." Cheryl sighed. "I have to live my life, Mom. There are things I have to do." Cheryl spent that Saturday night at her mother's home. They watched a movie, Queen of the Starlight Ballroom, a sentimental story about romance between lonely people in their 60s, with Maureen Stapleton and Charles Durning. On Sunday, Cheryl told her mother that she wanted to visit her sisters. That was rather unusual. Susan and Cheryl had always been very close, but Cheryl hadn't seen Julia for 6 years. When Julia graduated from high school, she had left Longview immediately and headed for Seattle. She had been back in her hometown for only a short time. "Julia lived a few blocks from Mom's place," Susan said. "Cheryl and Mom walked over to see Julia. Then they drove over to my house." Susan still lived with her father, Bob McNanny, in the house that had been Cheryl's home, too, when she was in high school. The kitchen had just been retiled in shades of cobalt blue, and this was the first time Cheryl had seen the remodeling completed. They all sat around and talked. Michael's birthday was coming up in about 5 days, and Susan suggested that they all come down for a birthday party. Cheryl tried to be enthusiastic. "Cheryl was calm, even docile," Susan would remember. "She was usually moving a million miles an hour, but she was very peaceful. She wasn't depressed. She was passive. She was like someone I didn't know very well. She was subdued. That was not typical." Another thing Susan noticed was that Cheryl didn't talk about her divorce or the custody battle. That seemed strange because they had all talked about those topics for months. Susan had just baked rye bread and they all had some. Cheryl praised her sister's baking and then Susan played the piano for them. In a way, it was just like their usual visits. But Susan kept glancing at her sister, and she was appalled. Cheryl looked as if she was starving. She was pale, and she was so terribly quiet. "I hugged Cheryl when she left, and she felt almost non-existent, Susan said. She was so thin. Our last hug was much longer than usual. After they left Susan's, Betty and Cheryl went to Sears, and Cheryl bought some underwear and socks for the boys, paying with her Sears credit card. When they got back to Betty and Marv's house, they talked with him out in the driveway. Marv had been changing the oil in his car, and he noticed that Cheryl's Toyota van was dirty. He offered to wash it for her, and she thought about it for a moment. "No," she finally said. "I have to get back for the boys. There might be an accident on the freeway or something, and I might be late. Thanks, Marv. Maybe next time." Late that afternoon, Cheryl headed south on the I-5 freeway. The drive to Portland ordinarily takes an hour, and even though she had to stop briefly at her office at Garvey Schubert to pick up some papers, she would be at the house on the West Slope in plenty of time to welcome her three boys home from their weekend visit with their father. Jim Carr had also been in Longview for most of the weekend. He headed down to Gresham on Sunday to visit a friend and watch the Seahawks game. He planned to be back at the West Slope house in time to help Cheryl put the boys to bed. In Longview, Marv Trosseth returned from the grocery store a few minutes after 7. Betty told him that Cheryl had called, very upset. The boys weren't home yet. Brad had called her and said that he was having trouble with his gas line. Betty was worried. She thought maybe Cheryl should call the police and ask them to look for Brad and the boys. "I told her that you couldn't call the police just because someone was 15 or 20 minutes late," Marv said. That made sense, and Betty tried to be calm. But she had caught Cheryl's fear the way you catch a virus, and her dread grew with every passing minute. She called Susan between 7:10 and 7:15. "Mom said Cheryl was very upset because the boys weren't back," Susan remembered. "Mom was on edge because Cheryl was unreasonably concerned." It was unusual for Betty to call Susan and be so agitated. It was actually the first time Susan had heard her this way. "Mom wanted to go to Cheryl's house, and I told her to relax." Betty and Marv's phone rang just before 8 p.m. It was Cheryl. "Brad called and he wants me to meet him at that mobile station down by the IGA store, but I know that station's closed." "No," Betty said. "Don't go down there. I have to get my kids." Betty begged Cheryl to wait until she and Marv could drive down to Portland and go with her to pick up the boys, but Cheryl argued that would take an hour at least. She was going to go. She had to go. Betty couldn't change her daughter's mind. "You call me the second you get back to the house. Don't wait for anything. I want to know you're safely home." Cheryl promised she would. When Betty called Susan again that evening, she was on the edge of hysteria. She was terrified that Cheryl was going to meet Brad and told Susan that she thought she and Marv should head for Portland immediately. "Go to Portland if you want to go, Mom," Susan said. Now Susan was catching the fear, too. "Something's not right," Betty said. "I don't know what's happening." Susan put down the phone and told her father about Betty's two frantic phone calls. "I got very nervous, too. I had a lump in my throat all evening," Bob McNanny said. Betty waited anxiously for Cheryl's call. Trying to ease her mind, Marv placed calls to both Cheryl's number and Brad's. There was no answer at either, and no answering machine pickup. At Betty's urging, Marv kept calling, but no one answered. The next call that Betty received from the West Slope house was from her son, Jim. She grabbed the phone before the first ring was over, and when she heard Jim's voice, she cried, "She's dead, isn't she? Cheryl's dead!" Jim said that wasn't true. He didn't know where Cheryl was, but he had found a note from her, and he was going to go look for her. Betty was inconsolable. She knew her daughter was dead, and, of course, she was right. Brad had hired three separate attorneys to represent him in his divorce from Cheryl, dismissing them one after the other, even though they were the best in the business. He had consulted almost a dozen others. He need not have bothered. How ironic that he didn't need a divorce now. Nor would there be any more custody battles. Cheryl was dead. And Jess, Michael, and Philip were his alone. Part 4. Sarah. Chapter 33. Brad Cunningham had emerged as the prime suspect in the death of his estranged wife, but the time frame of Cheryl's murder was vitally important in establishing the possibility of his guilt. Brad could account for his movements on that Sunday night almost to the minute. If Danielle Daniels, one of the residents living along 79th where it entered the Sunset Highway, had heard the sounds of someone beating Cheryl to death, the time of the murder would have been between 8:20 and 8:25. In order for Oregon State Police detectives to be satisfied that Brad had nothing to do with the crime, they would have to talk to witnesses who could back up his alibi for that Sunday night. Brad didn't have to prove anything. In America, suspects and defendants are innocent until proven guilty. The legal burden of proof rested heavily on the detective's shoulders and on the Washington County District Attorney's Office. If they couldn't gather evidence and or witnesses that they believed would prove Brad guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, he would go free. There were numerous ways of checking on Brad, and the investigation was still fresh. Investigators could check phone records. Perhaps they could find outside witnesses who had had no interest in his activities that night, but who would remember seeing him. The problem was to locate everything and everyone who might be able to either validate Brad's story or discredit it. Brad's own 6-year-old son had told the grand jury that his father had left the apartment on Sunday night while he was watching a video and television. Children have little sense of the passage of time, but detectives did check the running time of The Sword in the Stone and of Rambo, the two movies Jess had been watching. If the boy's recollection was correct, Brad would have been away from the apartment for more than an hour. Officer Craig Ward of the Portland Police Bureau had a far better time sense than a 6-year-old boy, and so did Lilia Sarnen, Brad's former lover. Ward didn't see Cunningham that Sunday night, although he was in the Madison Tower parking garage. But Lilia did, and so did another tenant in the building. Officer Ward arrived at the Madison Tower between 8:21 and 8:27 Sunday evening in response to a car prowl complaint from Terry Houghton, a men's clothing salesman whose company van was parked in the garage on the B2 level. Ward took an elevator from the ground floor to the B1 level and then walked to B2. His notes reflected that he had spent 10 to 15 minutes at the van. Houghton had lost more than 100 sample suits and other items. After Ward had taken down that information, he and Houghton walked to the security gate and inspected it. "I was aware that two or three vehicles drove past," Ward recalled, "but I never saw any foot traffic at all." Rachel Houghton, however, did see a man and a child in the garage. She and her husband lived on the 7th floor of the Madison Tower, and they had 2 parking spaces in the garage. "We returned from a weekend trip to find our van had been broken into," she said, "and we called the police. While we were talking to the police, I saw someone come down the driveway into the parking structure, running. It was a man and a child entering the garage in a slow run or a fast walk. I had just been telling the officer how people got into the garage. The man had on shorts and a t-shirt. He was barefoot and he had wet hair." Later, Rachel Houghton would identify that man as Brad Cunningham. She sensed that he was startled to see a policeman in the garage. "He stopped abruptly and walked to a car and put something away, and then he headed toward the tower. The child and the running man in the shorts with wet hair hadn't meant anything to Rachel Houghton, not until she read about Cheryl Keaton's murder in the papers. She hadn't mentioned it to her husband, who was busy showing Craig Ward how the security gate operated. Later, she called police and told them what she had seen. She estimated that it was sometime around 9 p.m. when she saw the man and the little boy. Officer Ward cleared the Madison Tower at roughly 9 p.m. Lilia Sarnan, who lived on the first floor of the Madison Tower in G42, had been late for a shower given by a friend's mother that night. It was just past 7:30 p.m. when she stepped out of her door and encountered Brad and his small son, Michael. Brad was carrying keys in his hand. Early the next morning, Monday, Brad had called Lilia before she was even out of bed, asking her if she remembered seeing him in the hall the evening before. When she said she did, he said, "At 8 p.m., right?" "No, Brad," she corrected. "I saw you at 7:30. Brad abruptly hung up the phone. Lilia told her surgeon boyfriend that something about Brad's manner worried her. Later that morning at work, a friend called and asked, "Have you read the paper?" Lilia said she hadn't had time. "Cheryl Keaton got murdered last night," her friend said. "That's funny," Lilia said. "I just talked to Brad, and he didn't say anything about it." Lilia told Detective Jerry Finch about seeing Brad on Sunday evening. "My front door was one of four on the ground floor level. The elevator is on one side and the garden gate on the other. I was moving toward the garden gate at 7:30, and Brad and Michael were leaving the elevator." "How was he dressed?" Finch asked.
"Casually."
"How casually?"
"Khaki pants, I think, and a jacket."
When Mr. Cunningham and his son left the elevator, where were they headed?
"Toward the garage."
On October 10th, Oregon State Police investigators served a search warrant on Brad Cunningham's apartment. Richard McKiernan, Greg Baxter, Les Frank, and Jerry Finch conducted a search and found nothing that seemed truly helpful in their probe, either in the apartment or in Brad's storage locker at the Madison Tower. They did see a reflectorized vest with orange or yellow stripes, which they seized and marked into evidence. It might have been the vest that Jess said his father was wearing when he came back from jogging on the night of the murder. Or it might not have been. Brad would claim later it was a seldom-used hunting vest. Tests revealed no evidence of blood on the vest. If the detectives had hoped to find a heavy blunt instrument with many surfaces that might match the wounds Dr. Karen Gunson noted on Cheryl Keaton's autopsy report, and they had, they were disappointed. They found no weapon, no bloody clothes, and no running shoes with traces of red still etched in their bas-relief bottoms. To solve a murder, investigators need to show means, motive, opportunity, and physical evidence. The detectives assigned to the Keaton case were convinced they had a motive. Brad had hated his estranged wife, particularly after the deposition she gave 5 days before her murder. Brad also had the means. He was a strong man and had access to all manner of weapons. And he could have had the opportunity if he had been able to fit a murder into an extremely tight timetable. Some of those who could verify where Brad had been that night or establish time sequences, Dr. Sarah Gordon, Officer Craig Ward, the Houghtons, Lilia Sarnan, would make impeccable witnesses if they chose to cooperate with the state. Then there were his own little boys, although Jess, the oldest, was probably the only one whose recall might be accurate. But Sarah Gordon loved Brad Cunningham, and they had plans for the future. Lilia Sarnan had once been intimate with him, and she was still his friend, as well as Sarah Gordon's. And his own sons idolized their daddy. Detectives hoped that more witnesses would either come forward on their own or surface during the investigation. Just as a medical examiner may find that the last time the deceased was seen alive is the best way to establish time of death, the activities of a murder suspect are best charted by the last time he was seen before the murder by competent witnesses and the first time he was seen after the crime. Lilia Saarinen had seen Brad and Michael emerge from the elevator at the Madison Tower at 7:30 to 7:35 p.m. that Sunday. Cheryl was murdered between 8:20 and 8:30 p.m., and at around 9 p.m., Rachel Houghton saw Brad and a small boy in the garage of the Madison Tower. For an hour and a half, Brad's whereabouts were unaccounted for. Had he been taking care of Jess, Michael, and Philip during that time, waiting impatiently for his heedless, drunken, estranged wife to come for them? Had he left the apartment on the 18th floor only briefly, to peer down over the rail to watch for Cheryl, to put boots into Sarah's Cressida, to pick up the mail? That would fill up the vital time period. Or had he planned every minute of that Sunday evening and planned it with vile intention? Had he left Jess and Philip alone in his apartment and taken Michael with him as he set out to murder their mother? That would fill up the vital time period, too. Detectives would drive the route from Providence Hospital to the Madison Tower, to the West Slope, and back to the Madison Tower, with stopwatches in hand to prove that Brad could have done that on the night of the murder. It was certainly possible. Still, there was absolutely no physical evidence linking him to the crime. Chapter 34. In the days immediately following Cheryl's murder, Brad told confidants that his biggest fear was that her mother would take his children away from him. He had been trying to spirit Jess, Michael, and Philip away from Portland, but the best he could do was keep moving them from one house to the next over the ensuing 3 or 4 weeks. The first week, along with Sarah, they were mostly at his sister Margie's or Ginny Burton's, and that weekend they stayed with another of Sarah's sisters, Shirley, who lived in McMinnville, Sarah's hometown. Michael had his fifth birthday on September 26th, and he wanted to celebrate at Chuck E. Cheese's. While the flowers were still fresh on his mother's grave, Brad and Sarah tried to give Michael a wonderful birthday. Then suddenly, after Brad's three sons had become such an integral part of Sarah's life, they disappeared. It was just one more component in a world that was growing steadily sadder and more frightening. "I didn't see the boys after that," Sarah would recall. "Not for weeks. I asked Brad where they were, and he told me that he had had them taken out of state. I didn't know where they were." Brad had been unsuccessful in preventing his oldest son from appearing before the Washington County Grand Jury, of course. Still, when no arrest followed his testimony, he must have felt vindicated. The damn police had come and pawed through his apartment and his storage locker, but if they were looking for evidence that he had killed his wife, they didn't find it. How could they? He said he hadn't murdered Cheryl, and he didn't know who had. Brad's career with U.S. Bank faltered after her murder. His superiors were understanding when he didn't come in to work the first week. His estranged wife's death was a shock to everyone. But Brad never really went back to work. He showed up only sporadically. He had been considered a valuable employee for the almost 5 months he was with U.S. Bank. He was a man with an eye for property with potential. But now he had made unsavory headlines in Portland, and that was not the image that U.S. Bank, or any bank for that matter, would choose to project. Even so, Brad was given the benefit of the doubt. However, his poor attendance at work was brought to the attention of his boss, Larry Rosencrantz. Given Brad's apparent disinterest in his job, it was only a matter of time before U.S. Bank had to demand some response from him. Did he intend to come back to work? Brad met with Rosencrantz and poured out a story of a life that left little time for his career. He indicated to me that he was being harassed by the police and that he was being hounded by his mother-in-law, Rosencrantz recalled. That might explain why Brad had checked out 2 bank cars from the carpool in the 10 days after Cheryl's murder. One had to be retrieved from an airport lot in Seattle. Brad had apparently used them so that no one could follow him. He had had Sarah's car, his truck, his Suburban, his cabriolet, and the pool cars so that he could vary his transportation often. He wasn't fired from the U.S. bank job, but a mutually agreed arrangement was made. His contract was bought out, and he received $23,000. Everywhere Brad looked that fall, he found another facet of his life shattering. His sons had no mother. He had no job. His suit was jammed up in the Texas courts, and he told Sarah he lived in terror that he would lose his sons. He knew that Cheryl's law firm was helping Betty and Marv Trosseth, Bob McNanny, and John Burke in their efforts to gain custody of his children. Everyone but Sarah seemed to be against him. Finally, Brad came to the decision that the only way he could keep his sons was to hide them. He couldn't even tell Sarah where they were. He had possession of his sons, and he intended to keep them. The problem was that he needed help. He wasn't so naive that he didn't know the police were still following him, aware of most of his movements. He couldn't simply drive his sons away himself, he believed, without someone knowing where they were. His father would have helped him, he always had, but Sanford Cunningham had died 2 months before Cheryl. Brad detested his mother, and he had nothing good to say about his sisters Susan and Ethel. He refused to go to them for help with his sons. Later, his sisters said that they would have gladly sheltered the little boys. Brad was still close to his Uncle Jimmy, but he lived in Burien, Washington, Brad's old hometown, and anyone looking for his boys would check there first. Brad had other relatives in Washington State. Although he hadn't seen his Aunt Trudy Dreesen for decades, he thought of her now. Trudy was one of his grandfather Paul Cunningham's daughters by his second wife, a half-sister to Sanford and Jimmy, but a decade younger. She was married to Dr. Herman Dreesen, a chiropractor in Linwood, Washington. Trudy Dreesen, the one-time Seattle seafare queen, was still a beautiful woman in her 50s. She was also tender-hearted, and when she received Brad's call for help, she rushed to do what she could. She was appalled at the tragedy that had struck him and his children. And when he explained that it wouldn't even be safe for her to keep his sons with her in her Linwood home, she perceived the depth of his anxiety. She could see that Brad was shaken by what had happened and was terrified that he would lose his boys, too. "I have friends who will help," she said quickly. Trudy Dreesen talked with Florence Chamberlain, who lived in Port Angeles. Although Trudy had met Florence only twice, her son was dating the Chamberlain's daughter, and Trudy knew that the Chamberlains were good people who lived in a 3-story, 6-bedroom home. After Trudy explained that Brad was a widower who needed some place for his little boys, but only for a few weeks until he could find a permanent spot for them, Florence agreed to take Jess and Philip in. Brad had told his aunt that his 6-year-old and his 2-year-old should be together, but he wanted Michael, just 5, to be in another safe house. He didn't tell her why, and she didn't ask. Trudy and Herm Dreesen brought Jess and Philip to the Chamberlain's home. Florence showed them through the house and gave them their choice of the empty bedrooms. Jess selected the room with only 1 bed. It was clear that he and his little brother needed to be together. Florence saw that Trudy was very upset, truly fearful that someone was trying to snatch or somehow harm Brad's sons. Trudy asked her friend Jean Count, who lived in Bothell, if she would take Michael. Jean agreed readily, touched by the pathetic story Trudy told and how upset she was. Brad and Trudy brought Michael to her home. During the 2 or 3 weeks that Michael stayed with Jean Count, Brad came only once when he picked Michael up to take him to visit with Jess and Philip. In Port Angeles, Florence Chamberlain never met or spoke to Brad in person. When he brought Michael to see his two brothers, it was Trudy who took them outside to meet Brad and Michael. The three little Cunninghams romped on the lawn for about half an hour. Brad never called Florence to check on Jess and Philip. Florence Chamberlain and Jean Count were women in their middle years. They were very kind to the little boys in their care, even if they were slightly puzzled about why they had to be separated from their father. The children had arrived without even a change of underwear or socks, but Trudy gave her friends more than enough money to ensure that they had whatever they needed.
"I spent $25 on underwear for them," Florence Chamberlain would recall. "That was all."
Their mother had been dead for such a short time, and Jess, Michael, and Philip had already been dragged from pillar to post, moving almost every day. They had stayed with Sarah's friends and family, protected by a father who feared the police, unnamed assassins, and his ex-mother-in-law. Three entities he sometimes spoke of as equally dangerous. Now, for most of October, the boys were completely separated from their father, from Sarah, from anything they could remember of their former life. It had to have been worst for Michael. He didn't even have a brother to talk to when the lights were turned off at night. Almost instantly, Trudy Dreesen had become one of Brad's staunchest supporters. Even though she hadn't seen him for longer than she could remember, she was there for him now. That was the kind of woman she was, and her husband, Herm, backed her up. The Dreesens and Brad's other loyal supporters understood that he was hiding his boys to protect them, but there were others, Cheryl's family and friends, who felt he was determined to hide them from the police for fear that one or all of his sons might have some memories of the night of September 21st, memories that he hoped time would erase completely. Brad's 18th floor apartment in the Madison Tower stood empty. When his rent came due on October 3rd, Sarah paid the $1,200. On the 7th, she made his car payment. He had enough problems without having to face eviction or repossession of his Suburban. U.S. Bank owned his cabriolet now. On October 3rd, 1986, Sarah testified before the Washington County Grand Jury, which was still looking into Cheryl Keaton's murder. The ordeal she herself was undergoing was obvious. 12 days after Cheryl's death, she didn't know where Brad or the boys were. She didn't know if they were alive or dead. Sarah was a small woman to begin with. 100 pounds was a good weight for her. But she hadn't weighed that much for months. Now she was down to about 85 pounds, and there were dark circles under her eyes. She answered the grand juror's questions about her contacts with Brad on the night of September 21st, and she told of her calls to him after he left her at the Providence Hospital, calls that went unanswered. She didn't tell them about the purple bruise she had seen beneath Brad's arm when they showered together on September 24th. He had explained that to her satisfaction.
"I answered everything they asked," she said later. "I didn't volunteer information."
Sometime later that month, Brad got in contact with Sarah.
"He told me that he had taken the boys on a journey. Later, he said that he took them to Salt Lake City and he was looking for an underground system so that Cheryl's family could never have them. He told me he knew he would be taking a chance because even he might never be able to find them."
After a few weeks, Brad had picked Michael up from Jean Count and met the other boys at the Bainbridge Island ferry dock where Florence Chamberlain brought them. Apparently, he had decided against sending his boys into long-term hiding, or maybe he never found the underground system he was looking for. He brought them back from the journey and made new plans. One thing was certain. He refused to stay in the Portland area or even in the state of Oregon. Brad and Cheryl had purchased property east of the Cascade Mountains in Tampico, Washington, in the early 1980s. The little crossroads town west of Yakima was located between the Cowichi Mountains and the Lost Horse Plateau. Sanford Cunningham had lived there until his death, and Brad had been drawn to the area. He had taken most of his wives to Yakima County to hunt or to camp. After he lost the real estate project in Houston, he and Sanford had started their abortive businesses together there, the gas station, laundromat, and car wash. He and Cheryl owned two large parcels of land in Tampico, on which Brad had grown hay and built a barn and sheds. He fancied it had potential as a working ranch. There was a small house on the property, a rental, and the larger shell of what Brad would always call the family home. It was presently nothing more than exterior walls and a roof. This Tampico property was the refuge that Brad ran to around Halloween 1986. Even though the previous tenants had trashed the place, he and the boys moved into the rental house. Brad, Brent, Jess, Michael, and Philip were now living in a tiny house with cheap vinyl floors, urine-soaked carpets, and scarred walls. The place needed new wallpaper and cabinets, too. It was a radical departure from the lifestyle that Brad had become accustomed to, the huge homes and sumptuous apartments. Brad was down, but far from out. He had the $23,000 severance pay from U.S. Bank. Sarah had paid all his legal bills and his monthly obligations for September and October, and he was not unskilled as a carpenter. He bought supplies and quickly refurbished the rental house. It was anything but elegant, but it was warm, clean, and comfortable. Jess, Michael, and Philip were glad to be with their father, to sleep consecutive nights in the same beds in the same house, and to begin to trust that they would not have to move on soon again. The Cunningham boys were living in their own house, literally in their own house. Since they, too, qualified as tribal members, Brad had borrowed money from the Colville tribe in his younger son's names to buy this property. To her relief, Sarah was once again part of Brad's life and of the boys' lives. Perhaps they had a future after all. When Sanford died the previous July, Sarah had worried about how his widow, Mary, would manage. And she had bought the Prowler trailer that belonged to Brad's father, deliberately paying Mary way over book value. Now Sarah parked the Prowler in Tampico next to Brad's little house. The boys still believed that their mother had died in a car accident, and Brad felt they were much too young to know the truth. They were his children, and Sarah didn't try to interfere with his decision about what to tell them and when. Every chance she got, Sarah spent time in Washington with Brad and the boys. She either drove east on Highway 84 alongside the Columbia River, crossing the river to head north on Route 97 into eastern Washington, or she caught one of the little commuter airlines into Yakima. "When I visited," Sarah remembered, "Brad and I slept in my trailer, and Brent and the little boys slept in the two bedrooms in the house." Brad told his youngsters that their mother was gone, but now he had found them a new mom. "He wanted them to call me Mom," Sarah recalled. "And he always referred to Cheryl by her first name, so they began to call her Cheryl, too. He told me that he didn't think the kids would miss Cheryl at all." It was true that Sarah had never seen the boys cry for their lost mother. She was concerned that they seemed never to have gone through a grieving process. It was almost as if Brad had them under some kind of mental control. There was no question that they admired him, and she never saw him punish them physically. But she wondered at the excessively long time-outs Brad enforced. Often one son or another was ordered to stand in the corner, arms at his side, with his nose an inch or two from the wall, and instructed not to waver. Even Philip, who was not yet 3 years old, did his time at the wall.
If they moved, Brad extended the time, Sarah said. It might start at 10 minutes time out and end up being an hour.
Sarah wasn't present at the supper table in Tampico one night when one of the boys suddenly asked where their mother was. Had she heard Brad's reply, she would have been horrified. Brent was at the table and stopped eating when he heard his father's reply.
Your mother's turning to dust. Now eat your supper.
A month or two after Cheryl died, Sarah accompanied Brad and the little boys to Bunker Hill Cemetery outside Longview. They were still confused about where Cheryl had gone. It was a raw day, and it wasn't easy to find Cheryl's grave. It didn't yet have a marker or a tombstone on it. Finally, they located it far up at the top of the hill near the section that had been there for 100 years. Brad pointed to the grave and told the boys their mother was buried there in the earth. Michael looked at the spot, and Sarah heard the 5-year-old boy ask,
"But how can she breathe?"
It was arduous for Sarah to make the trips to Brad's house in Tampico. She had to arrange her on-call schedule very carefully, and she couldn't cut down on her work. She had been meeting not only her own financial obligations, but Brad's, too, plus his legal expenses. Still, she had fun when she was with Brad and the boys. It snowed early in Yakima County that year, and they made popcorn and hot chocolate after they played in the snow. Brad was resolute that he would never move back to Oregon. He told Sarah he could never get work in Portland. There was too much media interest in him there. He was making a life for himself in the Yakima area. He was taking care of his boys and building a shed for one of his tractors, and he had joined the local volunteer fire department. If and when he moved, it would not be back to Portland.
"He wanted me to move my practice to Seattle," Sarah said. "He wanted me to leave my family, my friends, my patients, my security in Portland and start all over again in Seattle. I made some inquiries about openings for anesthesiologists in Seattle, but I didn't want to go."
Despite her love for Brad and his sons, living with the aftermath of Cheryl's murder wore on Sarah. Although she believed absolutely that Brad had had nothing to do with her death, she had never really gotten over the memory of those first few weeks of terror, of their moving from place to place to escape the unseen forces that Brad insisted were stalking them. Brad had come into her life at Easter and made it wonderful, but by Thanksgiving it was hard for her even to remember those happy, carefree days. When Cheryl died, much of Sarah's joy had died, too. Sarah was having second thoughts.
"It wasn't just that he wanted me to move my practice to Seattle," she said. "He did things that upset me. He showed up at Providence Hospital one night looking like a street person. He was dirty, scrungy. He needed a shave. I was embarrassed."
Never once did Sarah complain about how much money she had spent on Brad. Money in and of itself had never mattered to her. People did. It was the complete upheaval of her life, her belief system, that made her rethink her decision to marry Brad. Brad seemed unaware that she was backing away. He and the boys went to McMinnville for Thanksgiving dinner at Sarah's sister's house, and they had a pleasant time. Later, they spent the night at Sarah's apartment in the Madison Tower. Brad had long since given up his own apartment. Regretfully, Sarah had made up her mind that she couldn't continue with Brad. After the boys were tucked into bed, she told him gently that she wanted to break up with him.
"Brad pleaded with me not to leave him," she recalled. "He told me that he would have a very hard time finding another partner at that stage in his life."
Sarah would not be dissuaded. She had agonized over her decision for a long time before she told him. She had fallen in love with a handsome, charming, self-confident, successful bank executive. She barely recognized that man in Brad anymore. She was shocked to learn he was nearly broke. He had spent the $23,000 U.S. Bank had given him to buy out his contract in September, spent it in 2 months. He seemed to have no discipline and no breaks on his behavior. It was true that he had bought building supplies to fix up the house in Tampico, but even so, he should have had half of that money left. They went to bed finally, with Brad still refusing to let Sarah go. He loved her. He needed her. Sometime later, Brad shook her awake. "Sarah," he said, "if something happens to me, will you take care of my kids?"
"Yes," she said sleepily. "Of course."
The next time Sarah woke up, Brad was gone. She looked around the apartment and couldn't find him. Alarmed, she got dressed and went down to the garage. His Suburban was gone. Where would he go in the pre-dawn hours? Sarah paced the floor of her apartment as Brad's son slept unaware. Brad was gone for 3 or 4 hours, and when he came back, he looked terrible. He looked like a broken man. "I was gonna jump off the 14th floor," he told her hoarsely. "I didn't have the nerve. I went out on the freeway and was gonna drive into a pole or something."
"Why?"
Sarah asked. "I couldn't live without you. I can't get a job. I'm being harassed by the Oregon State Police. What do I have to live for?" Sarah stared at him, wondering if he meant what he was saying, but finally she believed him. There was no way she could walk away and leave a man in such desperate straits. Brad needed her. The boys needed her. "All right," she said. "I'll stay with you for 1 year, but I'm not going to leave Portland. If you don't get your life together by then, I'll leave you." Brad smiled at last and folded her into his muscular arms. Chapter 35. Sarah realized that if they were all going to be together, they would need larger living quarters. Her apartment and Brad's tiny house, 190 miles away, would do only as stopgap measures. Counting Brent, there would be 6 of them when they merged their families. Sarah started looking for a house big enough for herself, Brad, and his 4 sons. Eventually, they settled on a beautiful estate in Dunthorpe, an upscale area in Lake Oswego. There was a huge gray house, a guest house, and a sweeping lawn where the boys could play. It would need some remodeling, but it was well worth the $250,000 asking price. Brad and his sons moved back to the Portland area in February 1987. He pointed out numerous things that he didn't like about the Dunthorpe house. The kitchen needed modernizing, and he felt a sweeping circular driveway would suit their estate better. Brad did some of the work himself, grading the driveway before a contractor paved it. He was quite adept at operating heavy equipment. "He took the cabinets out in the kitchen," Sarah said, "and tore down the kitchen wall." Mostly, however, she hired carpenters, electricians, and plumbers to do the work. In the end, it cost her $100,000 to remodel the Dunthorpe estate to Brad's specifications. She also agreed to finance a 1988 Whitewater jet boat that Brad felt would be fun for all of them. Brad had apparently been correct in his assumption that he couldn't get a job in Portland. "He tried for banking jobs," Sarah said. "He had a good interview at Rainier Bank, but he said U.S. Bank quashed that." So they soon settled into a pattern. Sarah was the breadwinner and Brad was the house husband. She left for work early each morning, and Brad gave the boys breakfast and took care of them until the sitter arrived. Brent went to Lincoln High, and Jess was in first grade, but Michael and Philip were still too young. Sarah changed her bank account at First Interstate so that Brad's name was on the checks and he could sign them. Now she was not only paying for child care, dental and medical care, and all the other expenses for Brent, Jess, Michael, and Philip, she was also paying Brad's support payments for Kate to Lonnie Ann. Indeed, she was paying for everything, even $210 a month on the baby grand piano that had impressed her so much when Brad first took her to his 18th floor apartment in the Madison Tower. Michael was taking piano lessons. That alone made the piano worthwhile for Sarah. Brad's contribution was to write the checks and sign them with his flamboyant signature. A year passed, and although Brad hadn't really gotten his life together, he and Sarah were married on November 27, 1987. She was his fifth wife. He was her fourth husband. She was determined to make this marriage work. She truly loved Brad, and she cared for his sons as if they were her own. Brad still couldn't seem to find a job, nothing in keeping with his education and talents. He had overseen a $600 million project in Houston, and he had been a top bank executive in Portland. He couldn't very well lower himself to taking an ordinary job. He and Sarah decided that he should go back to college. He registered at Portland State University in 1987 and 1988, and Sarah paid his tuition and expenses. Brad had no income at all. The Houston lawsuit continued to wend its weary and expensive way through the courts in Texas. Vinson and Elkins had taken the case on a contingency basis. If and when there was a judgment in Brad's favor, the law firm would take a large chunk of that. Beyond Sarah's support, Brad had another money source to tap, Cheryl's estate. He submitted a budget for the cost of raising Jess, Michael, and Philip, which included money to pay him for child care. He told Bob McNanny, one of the trustees of Cheryl's estate, that he needed just under $4,000 a month for the boys' expenses. He said he had to pay for their medical and dental bills, clothes, food, shelter, and for child care. He didn't mention, of course, that Sarah was already paying for all of that. When McNanny resisted and John Burke backed him up, Brad sued Cheryl's estate. In essence, the estate that she had set up for her sons then had to pay legal expenses to protect itself, but at least Brad wasn't able to penetrate the trust. He had another ingenious financial scheme. There was no question that he had suffered crushing business losses for years, and he said he had talked to a CPA who told him that Sarah could take advantage of those losses. She would have the benefit of $2 million in tax loss carry forward, Brad said, and would pay considerably lower taxes than if she hadn't married him. There would even come a time when Brad would claim that Sarah married him only because she wanted his tax write-offs. 1987 was the first year they filed their income tax jointly. However, Brad told Sarah that he learned on the very last day of the year that his tax loss could only be used against his income. He told Sarah that a CPA suggested that she pay Brad a salary of $55,000 on December 31, 1987. The sum was supposed to be returned into her account. Sarah did what she was told to do. "I signed a lot of signatures I shouldn't have signed," she would say years later. That was certainly one of them. Shortly after their marriage, Brad suggested to Sarah that she adopt his youngest sons. He said that she was their mother now, and there was no reason why she shouldn't cement her emotional bond with them legally. She agreed readily. Sarah loved Jess, Michael, and Philip as much as she could love any child she gave birth to. In March 1988, she legally adopted the three little boys. New birth certificates were issued. Now Sarah's name appeared on the line for mother. There was no longer any mention at all of Cheryl Keaton, the mother who had given birth to the boys and loved them so deeply. It wasn't Brad's idea, and it certainly wasn't Sarah's. She never wanted to replace Cheryl as the boy's mother. It was simply the way Oregon adoption law is written. But it was a little sad to see Cheryl's name erased from her son's lives, Sarah thought, as if she had never existed at all. If Cheryl herself had set out to find a mother who would love her little boys, she could not have found a better one than Sarah. But if she was sometimes disappointed that her relationship with Brad was not as idyllic as she had hoped it would be, Sarah was never disappointed with Jess, Michael, and Philip. She loved them devotedly. Without realizing it, she had given hostages to fortune. Brad remained the consummate entrepreneur. He was constantly thinking of ways to get back into the world of business. While he was attending classes at Portland State, he saw that there was a real need for a coffee shop close to the college. Not everyone wanted to eat at the college-run cafeteria. He visualized a bakery with fresh muffins, rolls, and bread, sandwiches, and coffee. He could even add a call-in takeout lunch run. If it was managed correctly, he figured that students and anyone with business near the campus would flock to patronize his small restaurant, good smells and a warm place to get out of the rain. Brad checked out buildings around the college and found one that seemed perfect. They could gut it, remodel the interior, and use the lower level for the bakery coffee shop. Later, when they got a liquor license, he envisioned a gourmet bistro upstairs. It was hard for Sarah to imagine that the deserted building could ever be turned into a desirable restaurant. "The kids said it best, I guess," she remembered. "The first time they saw it, they said, 'This is a piece of junk.'" Brad assured them all that the building was not junk. It was a tremendous opportunity. He had not lost one whit of his sales ability. When he believed in something, it was difficult not to catch his fervor, and Sarah was soon involved in his plans. "I agreed to finance the bakery," she later said. Brad would call it the Broadway Bakery, and the money drain began when Brad wrote a check on their joint account on April 11, 1988, to the city of Portland for a building permit, $115.63. Sarah would pour some $200,000 into the remodeling of the old building, transforming it into a bright, inviting restaurant. Brad was totally in charge of selecting the bakery equipment and hiring contractors and employees. Sarah paid the bills. The bakery opened in 1988 and the bistro, the upstairs restaurant, in July of 1989. The bakery barely kept its head above water, even though there was an enthusiastic response from customers. The bistro was a financial flop. Sarah had hoped that the Broadway Bakery and the bistro would provide some center and purpose for Brad. He had been through so many bad years. He no longer had a profession, or at least he couldn't find work in real estate or banking in Portland. He was only 39, and she couldn't picture him sitting around the Dunthorpe estate as some kind of glorified babysitter. Brad reassured Sarah that Symptovir, his formula for the alleviation of herpes symptoms, was still viable. She had never been enthusiastic about that product, however, whose base ingredient was olive oil, but Symptovir was no longer Brad's main interest. It wasn't going anywhere, although Sarah had paid those bills, too, buying cases of olive oil and chemicals, getting business cards printed. Brad chose Spectrum, the name of the division of U.S. Bank, for which he had recently been an executive, for his corporate name. Actually, he had several small corporations. Every time he opened up another section of the bakery building, he became another corporation. Sarah couldn't understand why he did that, but she had never claimed to have a head for business. A number of puzzling things happened to Sarah in the summer of 1989. She didn't understand all the ramifications, but an old friend of Cheryl's, an attorney named John Burke, was apparently trying to sue Brad over Cheryl's death. Brad didn't take it seriously, although he was incensed at almost anything Burke did. Burke and Bob McNanny administered the boy's trust fund, and Sarah knew that Brad felt that they were deliberately keeping him from getting money that the boys needed. Sarah was surprised when she learned the name of John Burke's attorney, Mike Shin. She had gone to college with Mike, and, worried about Brad and her sons, she wrote and chided him for causing new grief in her family's lives. They had all been through so much already. Shin delayed a reply until he was more familiar with the case. In the autumn of 1989, Sarah and Brad were having dinner at Jake's, a popular downtown Portland restaurant. She recognized Mike Shin sitting at another table and pointed him out to Brad. Later, Brad left their table briefly, and she saw him bend down to say something to Shin. Brad brushed her questions aside when he came back. At about the same time, Brad hired a young woman named Lynn Minero to work as assistant manager of the bakery. He was telling Sarah about his new employee when he suddenly volunteered, "You don't have to worry about her, Sarah. She's happily married and has two daughters." Sarah laughed at first. "You're happily married, and you have two daughters and four sons." Sarah had never been concerned that Brad might be unfaithful to her. They had had their differences, but this was simply not a problem that had ever crossed her mind. Now she looked up at him sharply. Why would Brad tell her not to worry about a new bakery employee just because she was a woman? He had been extolling Lynn's virtues and telling Sarah how attractive she was, but that hadn't worried Sarah. For the first time, she wondered, was Brad protesting too much? They spent most of their days apart now. Both Sarah and Brad had to leave the Dunthorpe house so early in the morning, she to go to surgery, he to head for the bakery, sometimes as early as 4 a.m. Their babysitter, Shannon Farrell, lived in the guest house on the property, and they knew the boys were well taken care of. If Sarah had a flaw, it was that she could be too trusting, too accepting, too generous. But she was an extremely smart woman, and once the first atonal ding of doubt sounded, she didn't have to be told twice. In retrospect, she realized that Brad had been much too complimentary of his new manager's appearance and much too enthusiastic about her as an employee. But he made his fatal error when he tried to allay suspicions his wife hadn't yet felt. Now she was suspicious. They spent Thanksgiving of 1989 on Sarah's brother's huge ranch in eastern Oregon. Brad was not the same. Sarah's feminine instincts told her that something was going on, and hell hath no better private detective than a suspicious wife. Sarah began to keep a journal, just as Cheryl had written notes before her. She began writing down her thoughts on Saturday, January 17, 1990. Her marriage was slightly more than 2 years old. She had adopted Brad's three youngest sons. She had invested almost $1 million in his enterprises and in their Dunthorpe home. And now she had the sickening apprehension that he was cheating on her at the very workplace she had funded to give him one more chance for financial success. January 27th, Brad went into bakery at 4 a.m. At 8:30, I called, and he wasn't at bakery. He called at 9, said he had put his new tire on and had gone to a cycle shop to fix something he had broken. February 1st, Brad met me at Fulton's Pub. He said he had given Lynn a ride. Said she couldn't get hold of Gary, Lynn's husband, so she called him and asked him to give her a ride home. Brad left bakery at 4:20. I called on portable phone at 4:50, 5:10, 5:25 with no answer. February 2nd, Brad met me to sign loan papers. He left at 3:05 to 3:10. I know he went right back to the bakery and picked Lynn up. I called his phone. He said he found the phone had been turned off accidentally. Sarah's journal noted numerous instances almost every day when Brad had not been where he said he was. She also wrote that Brad was very resentful about my asking about her, Lynn, being around. In February 1986, Cheryl Keaton had changed her will and the beneficiaries of her life insurance policy. In February 1990, Sarah Gordon changed the beneficiaries of her life insurance policy and also the terms of the loan she had just signed with Brad at First Interstate Bank. She did not tell Brad what she had done. Although Brad always had a plausible explanation for why he never seemed to be where he was supposed to be and why he didn't answer his mobile phone, Sarah's careful charting of his movements proved to her that Lynn Manero was often with him. Brad's behavior was now diametrically opposed to that of the man she had first known. Then, she could count on him to be exactly where he said he would be. He had always arrived for their dates on time. The only time he had faltered was the night Cheryl was murdered. Brad came down with stomach flu, he said, and he slept on the couch so that he wouldn't bother Sarah. She had another explanation for his behavior. February 6th. Brad stayed down on the couch all night, seemed angry with me, said he felt that Burke et al. Were persecuting him for something he hadn't done. Then said how he felt I was like them and persecuting him for something he hadn't done, i.e., affair with Lynn. Called me at work at 8 a.m., said his C-First Visa account had not been paid for 2 months and was I intentionally not paying his bills. Seemed rather upset. Sarah now knew in her heart that her marriage to Brad was not working out, but a faithless husband is far easier to say goodbye to than three little boys. She loved Jess and Michael and Philip so much that she wondered if she could bear to give them up. "I knew that Brad would never let me have the boys," she would recall wistfully. And she had to remember the vicious struggle that went on between Cheryl and Brad over their three sons. It would not be exaggerating to say that Sarah was going through emotional agony. If she stayed with Brad, she knew there would be countless early mornings and nights when she didn't know where he was or with whom. If she left him, she would lose the children who considered her their mother, and they would lose her. Chapter 36. 4 years had passed, but police files had never been closed on Cheryl Keaton's death. The investigators from the Oregon State Police and the Washington County District Attorney's Office simply ran out of leads. They had been unable to link Brad to Cheryl's murder with physical evidence. They had found no weapon, no bloody clothing, and no telltale trail of blood. They had talked to scores of people and found many who knew nothing that would help, and a number who were reluctant to become involved. Those who knew Brad did not want to go into detail about their relationships with him. On television and in the movies, circumstantial cases move along smoothly and charges are filed, witnesses burst out with new information or outright confessions, and the last 5 or 10 minutes of fictional mysteries always seem to bring satisfactory answers to complicated puzzles. There are usually even wonderfully convoluted, double-reverse twists to make the denouement more suspenseful. The death of Cheryl Keaton was, however, a tragically authentic event. Real life. Real death, as it were. After an exhaustive investigation, it began to look as if the person who had